Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much to all of our listeners, and I hope that the people who are our Patreon supporters are enjoying the bonus episodes that they get every 2 weeks. I know that we're getting a lot of feedback from people who are really enjoying the personalized recordings just for them. So be sure to go to Patreon if you want to be a supporter of the show. And to our listeners over the last couple of weeks in the United States and in Great Britain and Canada and Australia, and also in Sweden and Norway and Switzerland. So if you're from those places, be in touch. Let us know what you like about the show and what speaks to you there in your neck of the woods. And so for today, we have someone on the show, a very special guest. We have part one of my conversation with Tammy Sinovec. I've known Tammy for many years, and she is just now starting to share about her experiences in Scientology publicly. Her story is a long and complex one, but we feel there is a lot our listeners can learn from it. So we'll be sharing our first conversation now and a second one next week to ensure we cover as much ground as possible. Tammy was first introduced to Scientology in 1993 by a friend she met at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. At this vulnerable time in her life, the ready-made group of friends in Scientology were, of course, there to welcome her with open arms. Little did she know that she would become a dedicated Scientologist from that point on. Tammy became deeply immersed in the cult for 17 long years, while they controlled every aspect of her life. And in 2010, after completing 90 hours of quote-unquote counseling sessions, their kind of counseling, in an attempt to move up the ranks of Scientology, she realized the dream she had been chasing would never become a reality, and she began backing away quietly. Tammy would try to remain under the radar as she devoured all of the information about Scientology she was previously forbidden from accessing. It was at this point that Tammy sought counseling with me, actually, as she's open about. And we worked together to find ways to get through to her daughter, Julia, and to her now late husband, Derek, who were both still under Scientology's spell. By 2016, Derek was finally willing to work with Tammy to save their daughter. But sadly, he passed away on March 13th, 2021. And their daughter, unfortunately, remains in Scientology to this day, disconnected from her entire family. Today, on the third anniversary of Derek's passing, Tammy will be sharing the first part of her story in hopes that it might help other survivors cope with their own experience and hopefully gain insights on their healing journeys. Here's Tammy now. I am so happy to be talking to Tammy this morning. It is such a wonderful thing for you to be at this place where you can talk about what you've gone through, and you've gone through quite a bit. And I know that you have talked to Tony Ortega, who's also been on the show, so he's a familiar name to my listeners too. He's a fantastic, fantastic person, very devoted, just as you have been from behind the scenes. And so what I think is really wonderful is being able to talk to you now at this point where you can feel like you can talk about it. It's a nice thing to be able to finally put it into words. And so I want to welcome you and have you take a few moments just to introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, and what brings you to this show.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me on. I think I met you 2015, 16. I'm not really quite sure when I started to correspond with you professionally. And then I think in 2017 or 18 is when you started your podcast.
Good memory. Yeah, 2018, exactly.
And then I remember you offering anybody, you know, in your support group if they wanted to come on your podcast. And so this was something that I had wanted to do for a long time. You know, I did the interview with Tony and kind of gave a brief review of what I went through. With Tony, it was more, you know, me telling my story of like what happened. But I kind of want to share with your listeners about not just what happened, but more of like what I was thinking. What was I experiencing as far as like my observations compared to what I was being told? And I would like to talk about, you know, when I got up to the point where, you know, my husband and daughter were in Scientology, and now I'm going to work to get them out and get them to stay. So all of the steps that were taken, this was not just a one and done kind of thing. Oh, like, hey, I just got to tell you about Scientology. And then once I tell you all this, you're going to realize that this was no good. And so I want to go over like a little bit more of what was successful in getting my husband out and what has not worked to get my daughter out.
That sounds really, really good. And also the steps that you needed to take just on behalf of being able to be in touch with your daughter. I think people don't realize all the protocols and how endless the list is of things that you need to do or admit to or whatever else to get there. So I'm really glad you brought that up so we can get to that at some point in the story. And also that you do something very cool for a living. It's probably not cool to you anymore. But
yeah, it's okay.
But I think, you know, it helps people know you and, you know, that you really have this whole sort of scientific part of you, which is an interesting tie-in with belief systems and, you know, finding evidence and proof and the scientific method. I don't know if you want to talk for a sec about what you do.
First of all, let me just give you a little bit of a brief background as to people like, well, how did you ever get in a cult? Well, this was a little bit of a groundwork of what happened with me. My mother was married three times. By the time I graduated high school, I had gone to 8 different schools. We had lived in 16 different homes. So my upbringing was not very stable. And I adjusted to that. I would find ways to make that all okay, where I was always the new kid at school. But I do have to say that even though I had three fathers, you know, and I had, my mom had kids from each of the fathers, and I have stepbrothers and a stepsister, that all throughout that, I always felt loved. So I have to say that I grew up being very loved and cared for. You know, sometimes things were a little lean, you know, we had to make do with what we had. And, you know, I'm still frugal to a large extent. I was originally born in Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia, Levittown area, which is where David Miscavige was born and raised. In the same
yes, place. Yes. And Levittown has its own interesting architectural history, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we kind of joke around about it being like a social experiment. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
By the time I was in high school, I was into drugs pretty big time. And my mom decided to move us to a different house so we could be in a different school district so I could go to a school where I could kind of start over. So she did a lot of things to try to compensate for the unstable upbringing.
I mean, it is really an incredible thing when you see that. I mean, even with all of the new things and new people and the changes, she really did try to intervene and respond when things were needed and make decisions within a kind of chaotic framework, but still make decisions that really were trying to be kind and responsive to you and to her children. I give her a lot of credit for that.
Yeah. She had her own dance studio. She was a dance teacher. And so I grew up, my grandmother was a dance teacher too. So I started dancing when I was 3 years old. Grandmother, I took lessons from my grandmother, and then my mom, And then my mom had us going into Philadelphia. And so I went to Pennsylvania Academy of Ballet. And then I also went to Philadelphia College of Performing Arts when I was in my senior year, which was down on Broad Street in Philadelphia. So I've been in Philadelphia a lot. So after I left my first husband, I moved up to Vermont. That's where my biological dad, that's where he lived. And my brother, that's also from that, from my mother and that father, is the only one that was from that, from my mother and that father. He had moved his business up to Vermont and he was in optics. He has a company. He's been doing that since before I was born. That's how I started learning optics. And part of the reason I had gotten away from dance was because the drugs and alcohol, you know, I chose drugs and alcohol over dance. So I was never really that good anyway. So it's not it's not like, oh, wow, I threw my whole career away. No, I really wasn't that great. I you know, I was okay, but I wasn't great. Anyway, so I was up in Vermont for like 4 years. And my mom had been in psychiatric hospitals before. My mom had some issues with depression and stuff like that. So, you know, she had, you know, a history of going and seeking out counseling. And she had even taken me to a counselor before for a couple of visits. So I had some experience. You know, there was no drugging involved or anything. Oh my gosh. You know, Scientology is big on like the anti-psychiatry stuff. So,
oh yeah.
That, you know, reaching out to you eventually was like, oh, that was like, that was my point of no return. Oh, now I've done it, you know. But anyway, in Vermont, there's not a lot to do. There's a lot of bars. And so I continued with my, you know, even though I had left my first husband, he had cheated on me. He's since passed. He died of a drug overdose. So,
oh, wow. Yeah, so okay.
It's probably good that I left him when I did.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, so I was, you know, there in Vermont. And my mom had started going to AA meetings. She gave me a book. It was Adult Children of Alcoholics. And so I started looking at this like, wow, yeah. But the fact that she would do that, because, you know, the things that, you know, are characteristic of adult children of alcoholics were that she would be a person that would give that to me, really was that's how close we were. You know, so I started going to meetings for adult children of alcoholics, and some of these things kind of explained to me why I kind of acted the way I did. It helped to kind of make sense of things. It answered those questions. After going to meetings for a while, I started to realize, you know, I sort of have a little drinking problem myself. So I started going to AA meetings. Honestly, I don't know that I was an alcoholic so much as I really don't know. I mean, you know, you go to meetings to say, you know, my name is Tammy, I'm an alcoholic. But in the back of my mind, I just felt like I don't really feel like I was really. So I don't know. I'm not really, really sure. I did end up staying clean and sober for like 12 years off and on, and put together another 5 years on top of that. In between, and you know, I think I can take it or leave it. And sometimes I'll have a drink, and sometimes, but more often than not, I don't. I mean, I can go months without having a drink, and then I'll have a drink or two. If I go to a concert, stuff like that.
Right. And I wanted to say too, yes, I'm impressed that your mother gave you that book. It is a very big deal, actually, because she was saying, I want to have some sensitivity about how my decisions or my issues have impacted you. And that's a lovely, generous, selfless thing to do, actually. Yeah, very, very kind and honest, which you also have that trait of, like when you said, well, I wasn't a very good dancer. You're very real and relatable. And it's always good to talk to you for a lot of those reasons. And go back to that idea of, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. I want to mention that because there are a lot of people who get involved in 12-step and have to say, I am this. I am this diagnosis. I am this person. And they might not be. And most people are not alcoholics in the way that people talk about it physiologically but they have that as their self-medicated choice, or it's been modeled for them that that's what you do when you're having a rough time or life feels hard or something. But that isn't necessarily physically an issue or physiologically an issue, but has been sort of your emotional choice. And you realize that it's not impacting your life all that in a healthy way. So you want to do something about it. But yeah, I've always had an issue with people needing to say, I am this name and I am this issue.
Yeah, I don't know that I want to wear that label anymore. I mean, at the time, and I never really was okay with that label. When you grow up in an unstable home life, the way that I compensated often was to be obsessive about things. And so I have that personality where, you know, it's all or nothing. And it's just, and all of that, you know, it's black and white. And it's just, you know, I have a lot of that type of thinking. And that kind of also left me, you know, wanting for answers. And so that's kind of what left me susceptible to with the point where I went in and I met with Scientology for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward from Vermont, I lived in Connecticut for like 3 years after that. And then in 1990, I moved out to California. And I was working for an optical company out here that has since closed. And I work with like making glass, making lenses and stuff, like grinding and polishing and assembling, you know, lenses that will go into anything from mostly military stuff, you know, like, so everything, this, you know, like even like sensors, that's in everything. Even when you go to scan your stuff at the supermarket, those are, you know, low quality sensors, but there's sensors in like the Mars rover, that kind of thing. So missiles, satellites, all these things have optics, lots of optics to them. And so I have learned how to make that kind of thing. So that's what I do for work. And, you know, I don't want to go into too much more. I do have a security clearance.
That's fine. That's totally fine.
Yeah.
I make stuff. Yeah, period. but it is there is a symbolism there that I think is just beautiful of optics. And just before, when you brought up the point that your observations were different than what you were told, it's about what you see and if you can see it clearly. And so I think that's a very interesting tie-in with your life in general, that you make glass and optics, which is, I think, really quite a beautiful thread throughout this whole story. So yeah, so we can move off so you don't go against any kind of clearance. So yeah, go ahead.
So, well, first of all, I had been seeing a chiropractor, and I saw a girl there who, she used to date a guy that I was dating or had been dating, and both of us were no longer dating a guy. Then I had asked her where she had been. I hadn't seen her in meetings. And so, you know, she was very elusive. And eventually I got her to tell me that she was going to Dianetics and asked me if I had heard of it. And I had heard the name before, and I thought it was like one of these, you know, some, you know, Dale Carnegie or I don't know.
Right. Some self-help, you know, or something.
Yeah, some kind of thing like that. And I had already had my own little AA thing going on. So, but I had also been going, when I was going to AA meetings, I had trouble with the whole God thing. You know, I was frustrated with that because I felt like, you know, I was just saying what I observed and how I felt. And I didn't, when I would go to meetings, I don't get it. I don't understand it. It's not that I had any problem with people who did believe in God or whatever they wanted to believe in. I just didn't feel like, you know, that this was something that was real to me. And in fact, I had actually been reading stuff about atheism, and that made more sense to me. You know, I was very, you know, because logic was sort of my God. Like, I'm just going to use logic here, you know? And to me, it didn't seem logical that there were just too many things as in Scientology where outpoints, these were things that, I don't know, what's another word for outpoints? What would, What would be a non-Scientology word for out points? I have to think about that.
Yeah, that's okay. So let's describe out points and I'll come up with the word. So go ahead, start talking about what it is and I'll find us. Hopefully that's the right thing.
So like an out point would be, you know, the Virgin Mary. I mean, wait a minute. Isn't this the lady who gave birth? How is that? I mean, these are the kind of things that I would just go, you know, hey, no, I don't, I'm just not buying this whole virgin story, you know?
Right. Yeah. Things that feel contradictory, things that feel false, then they don't quite make sense. They're important, but it doesn't come together logically.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I guess like, well, Chris Shelton talks about, you know, critical, that's his, the critical thinker, you know, being able to look at the information and say, you know, wait a minute, how does that apply? Or how does it not apply? So I think AA was not doing it for me anymore. But I didn't have anything else to replace it. Anyway, so 6 years I've been clean and sober by the time I went in there. And then as soon as I went in, I started taking the introductory courses. Okay. And those at first seem innocuous and somewhat interesting, but not like, oh, wow, this is great. I finally found the answer to all my questions. It was not like that for me. In fact, it was very weird. You know, these are the observations. Like the first time I was in the course room, somebody had a basket full of these little knick-knacky things. And this was called a demo kit, short for demonstration, which was one of the things that you would do when you tried to explain something to somebody as you take these little pieces out of this basket and try to demonstrate the concept. It was supposed to give it some mass. It's the whole concept. And I had not studied, I didn't know about this as like a barrier to study. It was one of the three barriers to study. But there was somebody next to me that was playing around with this stuff in this basket. And I thought, that's weird. I mean, you know, this is the things that I noticed and I thought, that's weird. You know, soon after that, I would learn what this demo kit was used for. And then eventually it would move on to where you would start to do these demonstrations with clay, which I hated even more. I hated both of them. Like really doing that whole thing was just, to me, what a waste of life. You know, just those are hours that I'm just never going to get back.
Yes.
Really, really. And then, you know, the other thing is, you know, looking up your words, you know, if you don't understand something, you know, it's not that, it's just, there must be a word, you know, or a symbol there that you don't fully understand. And then there's this whole regimen of what you need to do to understand the word. And you know, so that you don't have any misunderstood words. The thing was, is in a lot of these things that I was studying, like from the start, like the eight dynamics, and dynamic is supposed to be an urge towards survival. And so there's, and I'm not going to go through them. You've had other Scientologists on your podcast. It's very boring, but these are all these different urges, you know, yourself, your family, blah, 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 you know, the plants, animals, whatever. Okay, who cares? I don't want to educate people on Dianetics and Scientology. I barely got it myself, honestly. But the eighth dynamic is like, you know, the infinite higher power or God or something like this. And remember, I had an issue with this. I still have an issue with this at this point as I'm getting in. And that was when I met my husband to be. And I was saying, you know, I was told when I signed up that hey, you don't have to believe in anything, you know, including if you are an atheist, that's fine. You're accepted here. All are welcome in Scientology. I'll gladly take your money, no matter what you believe. You can believe whatever you want, as long as you write that check, which is really, that's what Scientology is. It's just a money-making scheme. I see that now, but at the time I didn't. So that was when I first met my husband, and he was supervising in the course room, and he asked me what my misunderstood word was. And I was like, well, I understand what this says, and I'm not buying it. and I'm not doing this. And I was told when I came in that I didn't have to. And he's like, well, most people believe in something. I'm like, well, this is where we part ways here, because but if I was smart, I would have left then. But I would not have married my husband. So there you go. And that was part of it. I remember thinking, this guy is a jerk. I don't like him. But then he went away for a while, and then he came back and we met up again. He asked me out to dinner. We went out to dinner, and you know, so now I'm to the point where I need to do like the purification rundown, which is go in the sauna and sweat out. So I'm thinking, okay, because they're like, hey, I was considered to be a heavy drug case. I did do a lot of drugs. And so I lost a few brain cells. I did. And those I'm not going to get back either. No matter how much Scientology I did, I never did get those brain cells back. I can pretty much say that those are gone.
Right. Yes. No matter how much word clearing you do in your life.
Yeah. No, it doesn't matter. No word clearing, no auditing. Nothing's going to. They had plenty of things along the way. The first step being this purification rundown. And I was on it for quite a while. And I did not like it. It was awful.
Yeah. Can you actually talk about the awfulness? Because I know we've had people on who, you know, ran some of the Narcanon centers and, you know, and I remember talking to Jerry Whitfield years and years ago about, you know, the Purif and the studies that were done and about taking copious amounts of niacin and what it does. And people who have trauma also from being in a sauna for so long. So I'm just curious, even just for a few moments, if you could talk about what you did not like about it.
Okay. So the amount of time that you have to be dedicated to this every single day, to whatever point you reach the point where you have, there's some sort of realization where there's something that's not turning on anymore. When they say turning on, there's like certain manifestations of this, the drugs running out in theory. Never mind the fact that you've taken, you know, tons of niacin and other vitamins and stuff like that. The amount of time, well, first of all, but when I started doing the Purif, by that time, I had stopped going to AA meetings entirely because I didn't have time. That, you know, it basically already Scientology had taken the time that I was going to meetings, had already slowly backed away from doing that. So with me going, because I was working full time still when I did my Purif, so then I'd have to come in and do this purification rundown, and it would be like 4 hours at least, of which 3 hours of it at least was in the sauna itself. And we were just sweating. And I read Battlefield Earth while I was in the sauna. The glue from the pages kept coming out. So I'd read the page. I tried to keep it all together. I was reading Battlefield Earth while I'm in the sauna, which is a bizarre book. I actually liked the book. That's probably the only. I tried reading some of the other Mission Earth fiction, science fiction books. It's bizarre, you know. I mean, Battlefield Earth was pretty bizarre too, but it was easy. It was something to do while I was in the sauna, so I kind of liked it. You know, I will admit that the movie not so much.
Right. Oh God.
Yeah, that was bad. That was, we walked out of, I mean, we were still in, and Derek and I, my husband Derek, we went to see it in the theater, and oh my God, we were just left with like, oh John, what did you do? You know. So.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it was so uncomfortably bad. Right. So all these books, I mean, some people really like the L. Ron Hubbard science fiction books and some don't, but it's incredible how many books he wrote. And then also it says something about how hot it was in the sauna that the glue kept kind of loosening and the pages coming apart. And that does says a lot, actually.
Yeah. I don't know I don't remember what the temperature had to be in there, but it was hot and you would have to sweat. And I was never, you know, even when I was dancing and stuff like that, I'm not a sweater. I don't sweat. a whole lot. So for me, you know, to have any kind of drip of sweat was uncomfortable. I didn't like that, but they really wanted me to get dripping. They wanted me to be dripping. And I would come out and take a break, and they kept saying, you know, you need to, you know, you had enough of a break. You need to get back in there and get in there. And but it wasn't just being in the sauna. You had to take calcium, magnesium. Well, calcium, magnesium gives you diarrhea. That was one of the first things that, you know, I was given the wrong amount. They had the guy that normally was running the Purif in charge. He wasn't there that day. It was a kid that worked at the mission. And he had given me, and you have to take oil. Like there's a couple different types of oil that gets mixed in with lecithin to help absorb it in your body. So between the calcium and magnesium and the oil, you know, I was like, and they're like, oh yeah, you're running it out. Yeah, no, you're just giving me so much calcium and magnesium and lecithin and oil. And so it was around Christmas time because I went to the Christmas party that night that kid had given me all that wrong amount. And I was just like in the bathroom constantly. And then that was one of the nights that my husband had just come back from Las Vegas. And so his car broke down and I was having dinner. We had our dinner there and he was talking and he was like loud and he had to be the center of attention. And I was just like, I didn't like loud people. And I don't like people who are wanting to be the center of attention. And I didn't really, I mean, I was like, red flag, this guy's trouble. Right. And I don't know how it's so weird that I ever ended up with him, right? So if nothing good came out of Scientology, at least I met my husband there. And, you know, we had been married for 16 years before he passed away from cancer. And he just passed away March 13th will be 3 years already.
3 years. Oh my goodness. Okay. Yeah.
So, wow. Anyway, that's the end of my story. We don't go right there right now.
Right. No, we will definitely get to that.
But I just want to say that was one good thing.
Right. Yes, you know? Exactly.
Because when my mom passed away in 2013, she had had like spinal meningitis when she was little. It may have been polio. It's unsure which it was. But at the time, they diagnosed her with spinal meningitis. So she had really bad major scoliosis. And big hump on one side. But she taught dancing through all of this. That probably kept her in better shape, you know. But she, when I went to go visit her right before she passed in 2013, we were talking about regrets. I had said, you know, my biggest regret was that I had ever gotten involved in Scientology. And her response was, but you wouldn't have met your husband and had three beautiful children, you know. And she had regretted that she'd been married three times. And I said, yeah, but you got two children from your first husband, a child from your second husband, and a child from your third husband. And then I have a stepsister from my third father, who she adopted also. And I have stepbrothers from my second father, his first marriage. So I'm very close with them. Family is very, very important to me, Rachel. I love my family. I hear people who have family members that they don't get along with. And I love all three of my fathers. I'm still in touch with them. You know, they had been, all three of them were at our wedding. My mom got to have her moment where the minister asked, who gives this bride away? And she said, her fathers and I. United. That was, she lived for that moment. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. And so I have, you know, I have a good family. I really do. I have wonderful brothers and my sister, stepbrothers and aunts and uncles and cousins. And all of them are so supportive and wonderful. Some of them may be a little tired of hearing me talk about Scientology, even after all these years of being out, but they know what I'm going through and they understand, you know, so.
Good. I'm glad. And it sets a tone to even more so for the rest of your story, which we might get to today or another time. But the separation from a family member and what that's going to do to someone who is so family oriented, especially. I mean, it's never okay, even if you're not family oriented, but it hurts that much more if you are. Yeah. Okay. So then.
So the purification rundown
right.
was just horrendous. You know, and then moved on from there. And I did like life repair, which is it's kind of like tailor-made, but you start to get grooved in. You have to have your very first thing. They want to make sure that you're not connected to anybody who's suppressive. I'm a suppressive person now, so that I would be considered to be suppressive. So if somebody's connected to me, then they're going to be a potential trouble source because they're not going to get the gains that they could possibly get because somebody like me is saying, is that really real? Do you really think that's, you know, I would be questioning things. Okay, well, you don't want to be, they want to make sure you're not connected to anybody that would be questioning Scientology or putting any doubts in your mind about Scientology. So that was one of the first things that I went through. Even before I started the purification rundown, I had to do the initial, I don't even want to use the terminology, Rachel. I just hate, because then I have to try to explain it. And it's just, it's like as if it makes sense, as if I'm trying to explain like what the reactive mind is, as if there is such a thing, you know, and then later on explain, you know, going clear. You know, no longer having a reactive mind. Well, what is clear? Who cares? Because it's all made up. It's all made up. And, you know, knowing that now, but at the time, I didn't know that. And so I would say initially going through the very beginning things, I joined staff, like right after I had finished the purification program, I joined staff. I would have to go out knocking on doors, handing people personality tests, and finding out that people weren't really thrilled about this. People were not thrilled. Oh, that's Scientology. And I would, you know, I would start running into people questioning it, you know, or being not, you know, like slamming the door on my face, that kind of thing. I wasn't used to that. And so then I went, and after that, I went off to Florida to get training. And that was, you know, from the start, there were some things that were very strange about that because now I'm in like, quote, the Mecca of Scientology. They don't use that word anymore, Mecca, because it has, you know, has some different connotations to it. But anyway, I was rooming with Sea Org members. I was not in the Sea Organization, which is the ecclesiastical correlation to like somebody who's become a priest. You know, you're in for life. That's it. You're dedicated. That's all you do, you know, 24/7. And so and these people that are in the Sea Org, they sign billion-year contracts. You know, I'm sure you've heard about all this. Any of these contracts that you're signing, you're basically saying, you know, I've agreed to do this. These contracts are not binding. They're not real. None of this is real. But at the time, you know, you take it seriously. You think it's real.
Yeah. And even if it's not real, what I've noticed is that people who get involved in groups like Scientology, a lot of the time, they're very well-meaning and they make a commitment to something and they want to stay with it. And so they hold themselves up to a standard because they've signed something. And so that means they have to adhere to it because that's the way they approach things, which is actually really commendable. And so it is pretty devastating for people to find out that it doesn't mean anything. Even the personality test doesn't, you know, the way it was crafted by some, you know, someone who L. Ron Hubbard knew and, you know, and it's called Oxford for no reason, except that it sounds legitimate because you named it that. So, you know, just knowing that you were giving out these things also in a very open and well-meaning way. Like these are things that are supposed to help you and help you know you and help you know what you need in this world to, you know, get help with. And I'm going to help facilitate that. You know, you don't think, is this full of crap? Like, what am I handing people? You don't think to ask that because people assume that what's true for themselves often is true for other people. And if you put together something that was, let's you call it a personality test, it would be legitimate. Like it would be based in something scientific or something psychological, but it would have some merit to it.
Right. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Sure,
I didn't know that it wasn't tied to Oxford until a little bit later in my time as a staff member. I did question why Oxford. I did question that, you know, and I don't remember what the explanation was, but I was like, oh, okay, all right. You know, just, all right. Well, by that time, now you have friends in Scientology and they've love bombed you. They've told you how wonderful you are and how, you know, you're so, you know, you're such a big being and, you know, and you're special. And I know I didn't have a lot of that. I mean, I was loved, but I didn't have people telling me like I'm special. But so, and not having been in AA meetings now, these are my new people, right? And I look back at it now, like I see all of these things that I noticed were not, you know, or if I would ask a question, I didn't really get an answer. I wasn't really good at getting an answer to a question because I had my own self-doubts. I had my own insecurities about the loss of brain cells. You know, those are the things that I felt about myself. And so when I was with these people, they made me feel as though I was. They were focusing on what was ruining me, as it's called, finding the ruin, which was those things I just described of not feeling like I was anything special. You know, I was boring. I was plain, I guess. I'm just a plain person.
It's very interesting.
Nothing really special about me, right? And okay. So...
I mean, no, that's actually not true, but I understand why you may have felt that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I still struggle with that. You know, I still struggle with that.
I actually am hoping that through you telling your story and the feedback that I'm sure you're already getting, that would help you feel like you have, your story has merit and you have merit.
For me, like, you know, I was extremely nervous talking with Tony, although we had talked before, because even though I got into Scientology in 1993, that's 30 years. Even though I got out of Scientology in 2010, I was still involved in trying to, from 2010 until now, dealing with Scientology still. So it really is, I'm still not out of Scientology. You know what I mean? And I won't be until I get my daughter out. And even then, when I get my daughter out, I don't know that I'll be out of Scientology. I will always...
Right. Be impacted.
Yeah. Impacted mm-hmm. by it. It's part of my life.
Sure.
I can't separate it and say, okay, I'm done with that. I'm no longer in a cult. And I certainly would recognize if I was in a cult. And, you know, but I know that I've inoculated my two sons so that they will never be in a cult.
Right. Yes. But it's so powerful when your own personal experiences and the way you have educated your child then because of your experiences goes on to really save them and protect them in the future and gives them this idea of what to watch out for, even just what doesn't feel right about a situation enough to question it, which is so good. It's such a good safeguard. There are like 7 hours left of stuff to talk about. I think you had just started talking about going to Clearwater and living with people in the Sea Org. And that there's some weird things that happened there. I don't know if you wanted to pick it up there or if you wanted to move ahead.
There were a couple of things. So one of the staff members, there were some trainees that were there that were from the different organizations throughout the world. And one of them in particular was from, she was my roommate, actual room, and we had bunk beds. And I don't even remember her name, honestly. But she was on staff at Portland, and there was a shooting. Somebody came in and shot up, I think, two people or something. When I came back, soon after I came back, instead of coming back and being posted as an auditor, which is a counselor in Scientology's world, there was the Lisa McPherson case. And that was the first thing I got posted as being the ethics officer. So I would have to deal with, anybody coming in who had a situation where they had a family member that was telling them about somebody who died in the hands of Scientology. And I hadn't even heard about it. What happened was I had the office, the person who was the director of special affairs from Santa Barbara contacted me and said, hey, you may hear something about this. And here's what they call dead agent. Here is material that will disprove whatever is being said. Well, I hadn't even heard what was being said. All I'm now hearing is this is what happened. And he basically described what happened is this girl, she had a mental breakdown. She, you know, went out in the street and was running through the streets with no clothes on. And so we tried to help her, but she died. And that was the end of story. That was it. You know, the whole explanation. Well, there is a whole lot more to that explanation.
Oh, yes, there is. It's a whole disturbing story and none of it on her. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the first thing. And that was, I think that was the same year or around the same time my daughter was born, Julia. I want to make sure that everybody knows that she's disconnected from me now. I'm not doxing her in any way other than to say that she lives in Clearwater. And she's doing her OT levels now. Again, like any of it means anything. I'm not going to try to explain it because it doesn't mean anything. It's just bullshit. It's just, you know, you're going to be, you know, a lot of these guys who are doing YouTube videos that can explain what all these, you know, what clear and the different OT levels and all of that kind of stuff.
But I like that you don't want to give it any more time.
I don't even want to try to explain, you know, that you're trying to get rid of these, how you came to have these things that you have to get rid of and blah, blah, blah. Who cares? Like I said at the beginning, is I wanted to focus on was just like that was a red flag that they had this dead agent pack that they didn't have something ready. So that to me seemed bizarre. Like that wasn't much. That story that they told me about Lisa McPherson seemed like it was missing some information there. I didn't want to be rude and ask, like, hey, are you giving me the full story here? Right? I have manners. To me, you know, I am following the social rules of having manners and being respectful, and which really set me up to be gullible. And so I think we're even taken advantage of.
Yeah. Well, I think naturally trusting, because again, back to this idea that you're going to assume that what's true for you is true for other people. If you say what you mean and you're a straight shooter, you're going to be expecting that other people, especially people involved in an organization that seems so high level and they care, that they're also going to be meaning what they say. Why would you think otherwise, right? Until it becomes clear that that is the case. Yeah, so people can look up OT levels, operating thetan. They can look up all these things on their own. And yes, luckily there's a lot of information out there now to have people explain it to their, hopefully to their satisfaction, still knowing that it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, I can explain about Xenu and all this and the blah, you know, but it's all make-believe.
Yeah, right.
It's all make-believe.
So I know we just have a few moments left, but and we will for sure continue and get into what's happened to you as more recently. But I want you to be able to kind of just finish up this piece of it, because you were just talking about your experiences. And I don't know if there was more you wanted to talk about when you said when you came back from being in Clearwater. Mm-hmm.
And being posted as ethics officer, and that Lisa McPherson thing was the first thing. And then I think one other thing about when I first came back also is there was a lot of the staff members' kids worked there. And I want to make sure that I tell that part. And maybe we can pick up on that next time, but that they worked there and that they were underage and they were not being schooled, that violates labor laws. And what happened was that the director of special affairs would show me, hey, there's state laws and there's federal laws, and the federal laws are more strict than the state laws. but we have to follow the federal laws. And I thought, okay, fair enough. You know, I thought, well, that was good. At least we're, but it was like, they were allowed to work for at a certain age, you're allowed to work, whatever the laws are. Oh, you're allowed to work like 4 hours a day. And these kids were there and they were working. You know, they're working, they were doing stuff for me. They were helping stuff envelopes, like a lot. And I was part of that. You know, I feel I have remorse for not standing up for them. They weren't my kids. You know, I was taking care of my kids, sort of. That's another story, is on staff and the lack of care and shuffling my kids off to, you know, daycare and stuff, that I wasn't there for them when they were little. And I missed that. I missed that. I feel robbed that I didn't have time with my kids. What all of that, the effect that that had on my relationship with my husband, because he was also a staff member part-time, and the struggle that we went through. So there was those five years of being on staff. Those are the things we'll pick up on next time we talk.
Okay. Yeah, let's do that. And I think that idea of, you know, you missing out on time with your own kids, that there are a lot of people who will say that they needed to put everything else first. And they needed to put their responsibilities to the group, to save the planet, you know, everything that you're pushed and driven to do. And they didn't have enough time. They didn't have enough time for their own kids. Sometimes for their own marriage, they didn't have enough time for themselves. And they were on post when they were sick. And, you know, they just couldn't say no to anything. They had to keep going and going. So, okay, so we will continue. And I'm so glad at least we're starting the discussion. So much of what you're talking about, it is so moving. And it's also so relatable for people who are getting involved in something and then suddenly having this awareness that it isn't what it said it was. And just when that starts to kind of fall apart, it's very difficult for the system to know what to do with that. Because, yeah, you've spent a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of everything. And to get into when people just want you to focus on the gains, but really we're going to be moving into the losses. And that's a harder part of the conversation, but really important. All righty. So I really look forward to the next part and the continuation of this. So this is a dot, dot, dot. And it is a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Tammy for starting to tell her story. It is a story that is so sad and a story that is also so much about strength and perseverance and endurance. And the fact that Tammy is still able to enjoy herself, have a sense of humor, work, have friendships, enjoy life, says a lot about her nature and her ability to handle so much. When I talk to Tammy, I'm so struck by the fact that still within Scientology, as she talked about, there is this real allergy to the reactive mind, that you're not supposed to have a reactive mind. You're not supposed to, because it gets in your way. It is the opposite somehow of an analytical mind. The truth, though, is that they're connected. They're not opposites. Once your brain analyzes something, then it reacts to it. And so, yes, sometimes you're going to react in a way that is emotional. And sometimes you're going to react in a way that's based on facts. But either way, you are going to react to a situation, and in that way, you're going to either learn something about the situation or learn something about yourself. There's really nothing to be afraid of. I think, along with so many other things that people are taught in cultic groups,
You're made to vilify something because it doesn't work for the leader. I think L. Ron Hubbard had a very hard time controlling his own emotions. And I think that's why he built what he built in order to feel good about himself. I think that's why he wrote copious amounts every day to just pour out so much. I think he was kind of a raw nerve when it came to life. And he needed so many accolades. He needed so much power. He needed to share what he thought were his pearls of wisdom with everyone. That's highly reactive. If he were someone who was just quietly confident, he wouldn't have started a cult. And at the same time, too, we want to look at the reactive mind as a safety net. And again, yes, for some people, it is exaggerated. Some people will go, they'll make that sound when something happens, and someone else might say, oh, that's interesting. Yes, some people react in a bigger way than others. But it doesn't mean there's something wrong with them. You want to say, oh, why did that panic someone when it didn't panic someone else? Let's see if we can understand that, as opposed to, let's see if we can make sure that they get rid of their reaction to things, if it feels at all emotional. When someone is using you, abusing you, and they want you to not be upset by it, they want you to go along with it, they will tell you that you are not supposed to have a reaction, i.e., a reactive kind of counter to what's happening. Whether it is that you get upset, or you say no, or you hesitate and don't agree to do something right away. Either way, it's a reaction. It is part of your reactive system. And it's not bad. It's not bad because it lets you know that maybe something is wrong here and maybe you're being taken advantage of. It helps you step back for a moment and say, oh, I just had a big reaction to this. I wonder why. But people have their hands kind of tied behind their backs when their ability to react is taken away. And then, to make matters worse, very often when they tell a story about how they've been treated or mistreated within environments like this or relationships like this, they're sometimes judged and blamed. Well, how come you didn't leave? And how come you didn't yell? And how come you didn't say no? Really? I'm going to be blamed no matter what? I'm going to be told that there's something wrong with me for reacting in a negative way, and then once I leave, I'm going to be told there's something wrong with me that I didn't react in a negative way? It is mind-bending. It is very difficult. And that's also why I tell people when they're talking to people who have been in these environments to not blame them for staying and to not have the focus be on them really at all in terms of why they found themselves unable to leave or why they found themselves going along with something without saying anything, usually because they were barred from it or they were made to be seen like there was something wrong with them for reacting that way. What's also important is for people to really have a sense about where some of these diagnoses of what's wrong with you and how you're reacting in the wrong way come from. And something I've talked about before on the podcast, and I want to be able to repeat it because it's a story that is so, so powerful. And it says so much about how, again, mind-bending this group is, and how what's up is down and down is up. That when people fill out this personality test that is still given out in Scientology centers on the street, and it's often printed on pink paper, so it seems kind of innocuous and safe. And as we talked about, it's called Oxford test and, you know, has the word Oxford in it, as though it somehow is from Oxford University, and it is not. But something that people don't know This was something that I was told by an original member of Scientology, someone who was there when it was the Dianetic Center and then as it transformed into being Scientology. And he was already about 80 when he told me this story, and this was many years ago. I don't know if he's still around. If he is, please get in touch. I want to be able to thank you for this story. But he remembers that L. Ron Hubbard was the first person to take this personality test. His friends are the ones who developed it, or his friend was the one who developed it and gave it to him first. So L. Ron Hubbard's answers are considered the right answers. They're considered the healthy answers. But L. Ron Hubbard was not well psychologically. So imagine what that means. That then you might be healthy psychologically. You take the test and your answers are different than L. Ron Hubbard's, which they should be. But they're seen as somehow signs that you have issues. Again, what's up is down and down is up. So you are then given all these courses to help you with all of these issues that you have based on your test results that are based on the answers that L. Ron Hubbard gave. And so there it begins. The fact that you never know if what you're being told about yourself is at all accurate. And all the more reason to make sure that you don't use Scientology as a guide for how to feel about you and what's true about you. Tammy, I'm sure, was told many things about herself that were not at all positive while she was in the group. And now that she's out, she gets to have moments like this where people can say, wow, she is actually a really strong person. She was actually able to persevere and she cares. She cares about getting the word out. She's being vilified by Scientology, but she's being supported by us, the public. Thank you, Tammy, for all that you're doing to get your story out there, to do education and prevention. And be sure to check in with us next week for part two. Take care.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @IndoctrinationPodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.